The Spectator magazine is home to wonderful writing, insightful analysis, and unrivaled books and arts reviews. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, along with a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to the Edition podcast, where each week we shed a little light on the thought process behind putting the world's oldest weekly magazine to bed. I'm Gus Carter, The Spectator's Deputy Features Editor.
And I'm Laura Prendergast, The Spectator's Executive Editor. This week we'll be talking about the rise of political prosecutions, Katie Ball's interviews Jamie Driscoll, and we'll be meeting the revolutionaries of youth demand.
Laura, we're speaking on Wednesday afternoon. The magazine went to press earlier today, and our cover line is The Usual Targets, the Rise of Political Prosecutions. Can you take us through how that idea came about?
Of course, Gus. So this week, obviously there was the news this week about Trump's trial beginning, but Angela Rayner is also now being investigated by Greater Manchester Police. And Kate Andrews is basically making the case in this week's issue that we shouldn't let the American trend of political persecutions come to Britain because it doesn't end well. So to discuss further, we spoke to Kate and The Spectator's editor, Fraser Nelson.
Kate, could you tell us a little bit about what brought this on and what's happening in the States?
Well, Trump showed up to his first criminal court case this week. The former president is facing four charges in this one. He faces a total of 91 charges across four cases. In theory, he could end up in prison for decades. I don't think people think that's the most likely outcome, but there is serious talk in the United States about the possibility of one of the two main presidential candidates running a campaign from jail, trying to govern from jail, pardoning themselves from going to jail. And the question of Trump's court case has weighed on my mind a lot, especially as people have naturally been asking each other in the States, or if you have an American accent in the UK, who you're going to vote for in November. And with two awful candidates, frankly, to choose from, my feeling, what I want most more than anything is not any particular candidate. It's not even any particular policy. I would like to vote for whoever stops this deliberate attempt to throw your political opponent in jail. And as the cover goes into this week, it isn't just Donald Trump. There's talk about what they're going to do to Joe Biden were he to leave office. This could become a perpetuating cycle of misery as we send the police after our political opponents. And the cover looks at why on earth anybody would want to import this kind of process to the UK. In the past 18 months, you had the police sent after Rishi Sunak for not wearing his seatbelt. You had the police digging up the garden of Nicola Sturgeon. You have the over a dozen police officers now looking into Angela Rayner and how she filled out the electoral register. This is not to say that politicians shouldn't be held to account. They must be held to account. But I think people know when others are being pursued with the police or through the courts for the sake of politics, and voters would much prefer to leave that to the voting booth.
And Fraser, where do you think this enthusiasm for political lawfare in Britain is coming from? Are we trying to Trumpify British politics?
I think it's the discovery that it's possible. I mean, until relatively recently, it wasn't. The first time this happened, I think, was the Cash for Honours investigation about two decades ago. Now, that happened when Angus McNeill, the sort of crofter from the Western Isles, was elected. And he found out that the average Labour peer had donated like £1 million to the Labour Party. And in this kind of Mr. Smith goes to Washington way, he goes, oh, this is scandalous, scandalous. And he found this 1921 law saying you're not allowed to sell political honours. Now, at the time, it seemed like a bit of a joke, but the Met Police took it seriously. And there followed a 14-month investigation with 135 people being interviewed, Tony Blair himself being interviewed, the first Prime Minister ever to be under a criminal investigation. All for something which was not illegal, certainly the way, in my view, in the way that the law had prescribed. But the sheer drama of that taught everybody that the police, if they're asked to go after a politician, they'll be so terrified of being seen not to do a thorough job that they will go overboard, and that it's possible to make your opponent look like a crook. The very idea of having a police officer in number 10 investigating Tony Blair, it was such, this is a tool which no opposition politician had ever really been able to deploy before. And after that, we've never really stopped. We've had all sorts of prosecutions, and the police have got the same instinct, but they really go overboard. Like Nicola Sturgeon, for example, was being investigated as part of a complaint about SNP bookkeeping. As far as I can work out, it doesn't go much worse than that. Yet we saw these scenes that make it look as if there was a body in her back garden being dug up. We had tents and helicopters and all sorts of things. So what you see is that the complaint is not put by a member of the public. The complaint is put by a political activist. So the complaint against Angela Rayner was put by the deputy chairman of the Conservative Party. And he was asked on television this week what he was actually complaining about. And he couldn't say. It was almost like he didn't really matter that much to them. So we are seeing now politicians realising that the police are so scared of being accused of not looking into political crimes, that they will go overboard and it is possible to deploy them as pawns, really, in a supercharged game of gotcha.
Kate, do you have some sympathy with the police? They have been put in quite a difficult position in the Rayner case, especially.
It is really tricky. And, you know, as Fraser says, in many ways, this is now a political game. Very worrying that we're using the police and law in a game, but she's playing it fairly well. She's learned from her boss, Keir Starmer, one thing you can do is basically say, look, I'll escalate the situation. If you find me, if you think I've done something wrong, I'll go. That puts a lot of weight on the police because they have to investigate this, otherwise they'll be seen to be protecting power. But, you know, if they were to find something, even something very minor, something very small, something that you certainly wouldn't be, you know, hauled up in a court for, perhaps something you would pay a fine over.
Seems quite fitting.
Let's keep that in. Then the police could be accused. Then the police could be the ones to decide that Angela Rayner isn't going to be the elected deputy head of the Labour Party. Again, that's something that, you know, really voters should be deciding, that the British public should be deciding. And yet now that does feel like it's increasingly in the hands of the police, depending on the decision that they make. So, yeah, I think it's an incredibly tricky situation. And it's not obvious to me that the Manchester Greater Police or the Met Police, that, you know, any of these groups want to be making these decisions that should be happening on the democratic level. Again, this is a really fine balance here, because as I write in the piece, if you look at something like Partygate, where within weeks you had ministers creating some of the most draconian laws for the rest of us that they weren't following for themselves, you cannot give the impression that if you are an elected official, you are going to be above the law, that you're going to be completely exempt from the rules that everybody else has to follow. But I did have one MP get in touch with me this morning. They had read the piece and they agreed with the premise, and they said that their concern was, what if to become an MP, you now think you have to have the money or the access to a really good lawyer? This idea that, you know, if you seek elected power, people are going to try to go after you in the harshest way possible, and you have to be prepared for it. That's going to turn a lot of good people off from going into politics.
Fraser, there's an irony to the Rayner case, though, isn't there? Because she's been quite a vociferous voice in calling on the police to go after her opponents.
Yes, she has. I mean, during lockdown and other things, I mean, it's become almost part of the political discourse now that the police will be looking into this, etc. So she has been playing this game as well. But I do think that Angela Rayner basically makes politics a more interesting place. I think it would be a great shame if she would have to resign because of the way that she filled in her forms wrong, like a few years ago. It seems to be a strange test to hold every single person to, that you can't have made a single mistake going back. And if you do, it's a resignation effect. And I think that we do risk just making our politics even more boring, draining it of all sorts of characters. And when you look at the Labour front bench, you don't see that many characters there. And I think Rayner is one of them. I disagree with her politics, but I think her perspective, her unusual background, she brings certain things to the political debate. And she, you know, we're trawling through her family. Was she living with the father of her child or not? What was the second? You know, these are sort of personal details. Now, say if she did fill in the wrong form, even if she was guilty of some, capital gains tax she should have paid when she didn't, I would still regard that as relatively minor and not a resignation of state, but it's become one now, mainly because of Keir Starmer, actually, because he was, of course, said he would resign if the police found him guilty of drinking beer during lockdown. Now, nobody called for him to resign, but he only did that because he wanted to contrast himself with Boris Johnson, who hadn't said that he would resign if the police found him guilty over his lockdown infringement. So you can see how this game of one-upmanship has led to this ridiculous scenario of politicised campaigning, and the police used as political pawns and prosecutions by politics as other means.
Kate, just finally, as you say in your piece, I mean, it's becoming difficult to give up these gotcha moments. Do you think, I mean, we have a thirst for political drama, so do you think, if anything, politicians are giving people what they want, which is high drama?
Well, certainly in terms of the theatre of it all, yes. But this is part of the problem when you invoke the police. It almost doesn't matter at that point if you're innocent or guilty, because if you get the photographs, if you get the videos, if you get the headlines saying so-and-so has been interviewed, so-and-so is under arrest, that's the damage in many ways done. You know, you are now able to paint somebody as a crook regardless of what they've actually done or what, you know, a free and fair court would find they had done. So I think the theater is a huge part of this. And then many people would say, well, that's politics, right? And people are resigning all the time and, you know, scandals as old as time, and none of that's new. I think for me, and you know, maybe to distinguish a little bit from what Fraser said, is the actual use of the police. It's not the fact that politicians are accusing one another of being shady or this or that. It's when you start actually hauling people up in court for very political purposes. And, you know, in the case of a lot of the politicians we've discussed, that purpose is you are getting a bit too close to power. I don't agree with your politics. So now I'm going to use this massive force, this incredible force of the courts and the police to try to discredit you. I think that specifically is what we have to avoid. I don't pretend that politics is going to become this shiny, wonderful place where everybody smiles and gets along with each other and never says anything unkind. It's a warning, really, if you look at what's happening in the States and how the use of the police and courts is just not only tearing politics apart, but tearing the American people to shreds. Don't import anything like that. It's not worth it. You know, it starts small, but I think it can leave a society in ruin.
Gus, what did you enjoy in the magazine this week?
I particularly enjoyed a review of a book called Teeth, an Oral History by John Patrick Higgins. And it's basically about this guy who is very upset about the state of his teeth and goes through multiple rounds of dentistry, and at one point he eats a pot noodle and the turmeric sends his teeth bright yellow, and I just thought it was kind of funny and enjoyable.
Yeah, it's very funny, that book review.
What about you? What did you enjoy?
There's a piece by Arabella Byrne in this week's issue in which she writes in defence of mothers who smoke, which she says it's sort of obviously now frowned upon to smoke around children, but actually when she was growing up, it was completely normal. She's talking about it in relation to Rishi Sunak's proposal to stop children under the age of 15 from ever being able to buy cigarettes. I just felt there were quite a few moments in it that I don't smoke, I sort of found myself agreeing with. So I would.
Do you ever have a cigarette?
I haven't had a cigarette, I can't remember the last, I haven't had a cigarette since I was 25.
Okay.
So, no. But there have been moments when, actually reading her piece, I thought,
during this week,
it would be nice.
During this week, while we were getting the edition ready, where you felt like you needed a cigarette.
Yeah, well, I just thought the point that she makes that actually, you know, looking after children can be quite tiring and stressful. It is quite nice to just go and have a break, and a cigarette is obviously a good way to do that. Mm. So I did slightly think maybe I should take up smoking again, but not quite yet. There's also a great interview by Katie Balls where she speaks to Jamie Driscoll, who Starmer prevented from standing as a Labour mayor in North Tyne, who's standing as an independent. The full interview can be found in this week's magazine, but here's Katie speaking to Jamie.
Why do you think you were purged? Purged may be a political way of saying it, right? But you know, I mean, not allowed to stand as a Labour candidate. But I just wondered, what do you think?
The backstory to this is I won in 2019 and I wasn't supposed to. So you've got Nick Forbes there, who was leader of Newcastle. And to be fair to Nick, you know, he was the one who drove the devolution deal, so I understand why he was disappointed. But, you know, fair's fair. It was an open selection. I won it quite comfortably. But then he was deselected from his council seat, and there was no shenanigans. He just didn't turn up and no one knew who he was. There was no organising against him. But they'd been for a long time trying to stop me talking to members. So there would be, like, I'd be going to speak to a constituency meeting in what was this, Sunderland, South and Holborn. And then the party chair would get a call from the regional director saying, I had to disinvite me. All of that had been going on long before anything to do with Ken Loach. Actually, if you dig up the Guardian article, Starmer's Bullies, Aditya Chakrabarty, because I shared with him some of the emails that had sent me. So I've been asking, as a mayor, you're automatically allowed to contact your members. You get access to the data system.
Yeah.
And I didn't as a mayor. And I was saying, oh, it's broken. No, it's not. But so-and-so's gone. Oh, we can't put new people on. So actually, I've just asked so-and-so, and they have. It doesn't work for mayors. I said, look, and eventually got to the point where I said, look, put me on it, or I'm going straight to the NEC. And I got this email back saying, we will only let you contact members if you promise you won't run as mayor. And that was in the January. And I didn't speak to Ken Loach till in March. And I know even that is bizarre, you know. Ken Loach made three feature films here, talking to him at a film event, about films. Keir Starmer's been in a Ken Loach film and he used it in his leadership elections. Now, this doesn't stack up. Nobody believes that. And so they changed the rule on the selection of Metro mayors. I don't know if you know that in the party. And another thing they changed the rules on is that it's no longer subject to the rules of natural justice. So you can't even make a legal challenge. No, and that's what we're seeing. There is definitely a move to make the Labour Party just the parliamentary party, cutting off all influence from constituencies, from trade unions, things like that, much more the American Democrat. And that suits the people who are driving it. I don't think it suits the people of the Northeast. And that's the real irony, isn't it? In a selection about devolution, about taking power out of London, London decides who people are allowed to vote for.
Do you think, as opposed to creation of Metro Mayors and devolution, do you think it has already created this, almost evidenced by the fact that they're now changing the rules almost to limit it? Do you think it has created a stronger power base than was there before, in the sense, it seems to me, across different parties, you now have, much to the annoyance perhaps of Keir Starmer's team, that, they couldn't stop someone like Andy Burnham. And yes, they're trying to mend relations, but you do have these alternative power bases now, which if you look at where the main opposition for Keir Starmer comes, or the critical voices, it tends to be from the mayors or Anna Sara, for example.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. Plurality is missing. The whole point of a two-party system, let's be honest, it is that the parties serve as filters to allow different voices, plurality of ideas coming through. When you've got the Tory party, which actually has a great deal of plurality, I might argue not a great deal of pragmatism anymore, which was one of the things that a lot of Tories prided themselves on. But the Labour Party now it's a monoculture. There are people who've left the Labour Party who've described it as like leaving an abusive relationship. Councillors are losing them, even across the Northeast. There's a steady stream of them. And creation of Metro Mayors had two effects. One, an actually genuine constitutional governance effect. We've had the Northeast, I think, about 51 different schemes over the past 40 years to try and regenerate the economy, from RDAs and city deals and all the rest of it. None of them has succeeded. The only one's made any progress is Metro Mayors. And that's the only reason for that is it's the one that can't be controlled from London. You can't wipe out the Metro Mayor easily. Now, they could put through legislation to do it. When you've got someone elected in power, it's very hard to do that. Closing down a government agency, a minister can do very easily. Look, like the price partnerships, they're getting just wiped out. Nobody knows. So I think that's the big part of it. The Labour Party is, I remember working with Gordon Brown and his team on the Gordon Brown Commission, which later became the Take Back Control Bill. And when we got the first early briefing back with Gordon, me and Rachel were working at the time, and we were like, there's actually something in that. We're so used to this being like platitudes, cliches. And that's really good. The power for mayors to sponsor legislation in Parliament. Now, I would have used that to get some genuine fiscal devolution. I don't know if you've read my paper on regional wealth generation. Have a read. And that'll blow any Jamie's a Marxist out of the water. Jim O'Neill wrote the foreword for me. I was good, but then it got watered down. Then it became, oh, well, we'll reform the House of Lords. Then they've abandoned that.
Yeah, that point you said about perhaps a small plurality in the Tory party right now, and I just wondered, do you think there is more, I suppose, I don't mean diversity of thought in terms of you think it's a more diverse party, but do you think there is more space for different viewpoints in the Tory party these days?
I think what you've got in the Tory party is a civil war. Civil wars throughout history, you get a lot of interesting ideas come out. Not that many of them are necessarily terribly well thought out ideas, but you have a complete lack of any central authority. The Tory party's magic power was, we will unite to win elections. And they've lost that. completely. And that's why the toast there. The Labour Party faces the problem that by adopting literally every Tory fiscal and spending policy, what are they going to do that's different? The Tory Party's, a lot of its core vote comes from people on a fixed income and aren't really affected by this. The Labour Party's core vote is working people, not the public sector people. But quite soon, they're going to be striving against the Labour government, I would imagine. And what's going to happen then is they'll collapse. Now, as you know, pack the parliamentary party with loyalists and clones and rig the voting. I mean, under criminal investigation in Croydon for cybercrime and voter rigging, I mean, that's way beyond anything. There's always been shenanigans in politics. This is off the scale. So I think that's why you get a lot more noise and different ideas out of the Tory party. But is that all about coherent government? I really don't think it is.
Our lead book review this week is by Sam Leith, and it's a review of Salman Rushdie's new novel, Knife. Lara, can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yes, so Sam has reviewed Salman Rushdie's new book, Knife, Meditations After Attempted Murder. It's obviously quite grisly in parts. Clearly, the book is not necessarily the easiest read. But Sam interviewed Salman Rushdie a few years ago for The Spectator, so knows the subject very well. And here is Sam narrating some of that review.
At the beginning of 2022, he was living an ordinary and very happy life in New York with his fifth wife, the poet Rachel Eliza Griffiths. He had just finished a new novel, Victory. He was, as he now preferred to be, close to anonymous. The tabloids no longer pursued him, and this unexpected and fulfilling late life romance and marriage, about which he writes movingly, had gone, by design, almost unnoticed by the public. Then he went to give a meeting in Chautauqua, upstate New York, and a young man rushed out of the audience with a knife and tried to kill him. Looking back on the night before, Rushdie describes himself, happy in bed. The future rushes at him while he sleeps. Except, strangely, it's really the past returning, my own past rushing at me. The revenant past, seeking to drag me back in time. This murderous non-entity failed, just by a hair, to kill Rushdie. But he did make him, once again, the fatwa guy. The guy who got knifed. Knife is the book Rushdie has written to try to wrest the narrative back, to answer violence with art. When he wrote Joseph Anton, his long-delayed, or perhaps I should say long-considered, reckoning with the Satanic Verses affair, he cast it in the third person, halfway to fiction. There was no long gestation with Knife, though, and none of that metafictional tricksiness. This, as he told David Remnick in the first interview after he was released from hospital, would be in the first person. This is an I book. As he put it, when somebody wounds you 15 times, it definitely feels very first person.
There's a particularly gruesome bit in the review where Sam quotes that Salman Rushdie writes, "Dear reader, if you have never had a catheter inserted into your genital organ, do your very best to keep that record intact." And he also says, if you can avoid having your eyelid sewn shut, avoid it. It really, really hurts.
Yeah, and there's a bit where he says his eye popped out like a poached egg and rested upon his cheek, which I found quite unpleasant as well. But we can move on to to Max Jeffrey's eye-popping report from Youth Action. Is that what it's called?
It's called Youth Demand. I hadn't really heard of them until reading both Max's piece and Mary's column this week, because the Youth Demand was responsible for graffitiing on the MOD this week. Mary's column implores the MOD to clean it up because it's...
Yeah, it actually is really annoying. Like, the more I read it, the more irritated I got. That, yeah, they've covered the front of the MOD building in red paint, and Mary's been cycling past every morning on her way into work and getting more and more wound up about the fact that no one's bothered, none of the civil servants have bothered to call up the handyman to come and wash it off.
Mm. And Max, meanwhile, bedded in with the sort of revolutionaries of Youth Demand. I think what's particularly funny about it all is that they're kind of seasonal, and their seasons seem to be basically based around term time at university.
Yeah.
So they're going to get back going again sort of late June, which is obviously when term ends for university. So we spoke to Max and Ella Ward, a member of Youth Demand, earlier. So Max, in the magazine this week, you write about your time spent with Youth Demand. For listeners who aren't perhaps aware of Youth Demand, can you start by telling us a little bit about who they are and what you discovered when you spent time with them?
Yeah, sure. Youth Demand are a new protest movement. If you read about them online, a lot of people say that they're linked to Just Stop Oil, and they are kind of, it seems to me, sort of cousins. They all fall under a big group of protest organisations, which is called Umbrella. And their main demands, Youth Demand's main demands, are that Britain stop the sale of weapons to Israel, and also as a secondary aim, that there are no new oil and gas contracts in the UK. And Youth Demand had what I think is called an Action Week last week, where it had a series of demonstrations that got a lot of press coverage. So one of them was leaving toddlers' shoes outside of Keir Starmer's house, his family home, and this caused a bit of outrage. And also there was some throwing of red paint outside the Ministry of Defence.
Ella, you're a member of Youth Demand. Do you recognise Max's description?
Yeah. So Youth Demand, we are all, ordinary young people with a demand to stop buying and selling weapons with Israel. So a two-way arms embargo on Israel, and to stop all new oil and gas licences. And yeah, we had an Action Week last week and it went really well.
Yeah. And Max writes in the magazine about coming along to your after party, in which he has a drink with you guys and has a chat. I wonder what you made about some of the things that Max saw there, specifically the girl claiming to be on ketamine.
I wasn't at this party, so I really can't comment. But I mean, I think you've put a group of young people in a room having a party and you've made comments on what that looked like. I wasn't there, so I can't comment on what you did or didn't see.
Max, what's your take on the tactics of groups like Youth Demand? I mean, you say in your piece that they seem to venerate forebears like Gandhi, but their protest movement seems slightly different. What's your take on it?
Yeah, I think, well, as with any protest movement, I do think that it's mainly led by middle class kids, and I don't think there's not any problem with that, but it's quite interesting that that's the case. I think that their tactics are, to me, they seem quite ineffective. I think they get a lot of press coverage, but mainly seem to unite people in frustration. Politicians, Rishi Sunak said that the demonstration outside Keir Starmer's house was unacceptable, and in all honesty, I don't think they seem any closer to their aim of the UK stopping selling weapons to Israel.
I think, I think that part of the success is, I think this conversation is a testament to the success of last week's action. Youth Demand is, it has made headlines, and it means that we are having these conversations and we're discussing whether the UK should be sending weapons to a country that's committing genocide, whether we should be licensing new oil and gas with the overwhelming scientific evidence that that will cause collapse. We're a group of young people that are demanding better, and we're saying that we're not going to stand for it. In the UK, we've got a really rich history of civil resistance. It's how women have a right to vote. It's through the civil rights movements, the disability movements, the right to a weekend. You know, this is a historically proven way of achieving rapid social change. And yeah, we're just upholding this tradition.
And Ella, though, do you not think that we're not actually talking about whether we should now send weapons to Israel? Instead, we're just talking about the nature of the protests that Youth Demand carries out, whether it's a good idea, whether they should be turning up at politicians' houses, whether the police should be harsher on cracking down on people throwing paint on government buildings. Do you think that actually Youth Demand protests, though, are not overshadowing your aims?
I don't think so. I think we can get really bogged down looking at tactics and looking at whether things should or shouldn't be done in certain ways, but the conversations we need to be having are around the fact that politics is broken and around the fact that these two major parties are driving genocide. And a lot of the conversations that I've seen have been shifting towards that and are furthering those conversations.
Ella, you say you don't really want to talk about tactics, but it's you guys that are choosing to turn up outside the home of Keir Starmer, where his wife lives, where his children lives. I imagine it was probably quite an unpleasant experience for them. How do you feel about that?
I think that in ordinary circumstances, I definitely wouldn't go to an MP's house. I wouldn't want someone to come to my house. But I think we're not in ordinary circumstances. We're not in an ordinary time. We're in a time where a genocide is going on right now in Palestine. I think we all have to really emotionally connect with that. It's horrific. Every single day we open up our phones, we open the news and we see what's going on. And it's dead bodies. It's dead children. It's entire families being wiped out. It's, 13,000 children are dead. So the tactic of going to Keir Starmer's house and putting up a banner and sitting down outside with a flag and putting shoes towards his door, it's not comfortable for anyone involved. I don't think it's comfortable for the action takers. I don't think it's comfortable for anyone watching. And I'm not going to disavow that, you know, maybe his wife did really feel uncomfortable. But I think we do have to be having these conversations. And if going to the Houses of Parliament hasn't worked, if writing to our MPs hasn't worked, then I think we can do what is non-violently needed to make the change we need to see to start saving lives.
And just finally, Ella, in Max's piece, he mentioned some of the possible other targets. I think he mentions Rishi Sunak's pool. He mentions Eton. He mentions private jets. I mean, do those seem to you like sensible targets for youth demand?
Again, I wasn't at this meeting again, so I wasn't sure what was discussed. But I think a lot of what we're seeing is people wanting to target the super rich. And I think it's an acknowledgement that this issue has been created by a very small number of people, and that the climate crisis especially is benefiting a very small number of people whilst everyone else is suffering. And an acknowledgement that actions centred around the super rich might be an appropriate target going forward.
Ella, thanks so much for joining. Max, thank you. And that's everything this week. Unless Gus has anything else you want to...
Nope, I'm done. All my demands have been met.
Just a reminder that you can read everything we talked about in the magazine, and there's obviously plenty more. There's a great piece on kippers, for instance, which I've just spotted again. I'm Lara Prendergast.
And I'm Gus Carter, and thank you very much for listening.